This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Hi, welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. On this week's programme, I'll be getting briefed on whether we can afford good public services in Britain, and if so, how will we pay for them? One promise you won't hear in this election campaign: we'll make public services worse. Yet there's a developing worry that worse may be what they'll become. Our needs are growing, but are our means of satisfying them? So today, I'll be getting briefed on how to pay for our public services. Not from politicians, partisans or party campaigners. This being election time at the BBC, if we had one, we'd have to have them all. Today, I'll be listening to the experts and the people who think about this stuff all the time. The people leaders need to go to when they want to understand what's going on. I'll be asking them, how do we pay for the UK that we want? Step into the briefing room. Now, is this you?
I sort of just don't understand it. I don't understand half of where my tax is going.
We don't get what we pay taxes for in the first place.
We do pay a lot of taxes, but I don't see where the tax goes to. So I don't know where money's going to.
So first, very basically, where do their taxes go? Neil Rozelle's been counting the pennies, and here's his 90-second guide.
For every pound you give the government, it spends about 30p on Social Security. That's pensions, tax credits, disability and housing benefits, and so on. It spends about 20p on health. So half of all government spending goes on just these two areas, health and Social Security. Education? About 10p. Defence? About 5p. Same for interest payments on the national debt. And the police. By now the government has spent about 75p of that pound it took from you. The rest? Think transportation, culture, environmental protection, agriculture, science and technology, economic development, and so on. Finally, something that's often talked about. Foreign aid. It gets less than 2p from every pound the government takes from you. That's how they spend your money.
So that's where the money goes. Now, what's been happening to the things it buys? Public services. Joining me in the briefing room is Emily Andrews. She's a senior researcher with the Institute for Government, which is a non-partisan think tank. And she runs something called the Performance Tracker. Emily, what is that?
So the Performance Tracker is a data-driven analysis of the performance of government. Now, performance obviously is something that's subjective politically, but you can kind of judge the performance of government in terms of what governments have said they're going to do. So in the early 2000s, indeed throughout the 2000s, we had a sustained growth in spending in public services, but then we had the crash in 2007-08. At that point, we get a much steeper growth in spending, and that's coupled with a fall in tax revenues In 2007-08, the financial crash comes along. You see a sharp increase in public spending. And then in 2010, the coalition comes in and says this deficit that's been created by those two events needs to be closed. So they said that they would control spending, but they didn't say they'd do it at any cost. They also said that they would maintain or even improve the scope and quality of public services, so the things that they're spending that money on. According to our analysis, up to around 2013, they did really manage that. So they really did manage to control spending across a range of services while also maintaining quality broadly. But then around 2013-14, some warning signs start to appear. And we've seen since then some of the pressures getting even worse.
So where are the public services where you think we can say that over the last few years we have begun to see problems?
OK, so the NHS is quite a classic one where we've seen the kind of the government targets which were being met up to around 2012 starting to fall. Elsewhere in the NHS we can see delayed transfers of care, which while something that is kind of expressed in hospitals, so this is the number of people who are in a hospital bed but medically are fit for discharge, the number of people who are there due to problems in social care has actually risen very sharply in the last few years. And the largest reason for that is because they're waiting for care in their own home. So that's suggesting problems in social care. Prisons is another sector where we've kind of seen big problems. So they've had huge decreases in spending, around 21% between 2009-10 and 2015-16. At first, that was managed quite well. And up to around 2013-14, violence was relatively flat. But between 2014 and 2016, assaults on staff by prisoners rose by 60%. So that's a large increase in
now, very broad brush question, maybe absurdly broad brush. How can we be sure that we can attribute the problems of performance you're talking about to a lack of cash?
Well, we can't. But one thing that we can do is say that initially, when it seemed that spending was being controlled, which isn't the same as spending being cut. Of course, in hospitals, spending was going up during this period, but it just wasn't going up as much as demand for those services was. So that's a control in spending. So in the first few years, while that was being managed, how it was being done was through short-term efficiencies. So services tightened their belts. They reduced staff numbers. They held down wages, and that allowed them to carry on for a while. But after around 3 or 4 years, those strategies started to run out of road. The really hard things that make public services more sustainable in the long term, so that's things like service integration, transforming the way that you do things, they're very difficult, and they weren't done in the beginning of the last Parliament because no one thought that austerity was going to last this long.
So let me make sure I understand you. Things like you can hold down wages in the public sector, but sooner or later you begin to get problems, what, of recruitment, of retention?
So we have seen problems, of course, in the NHS. Actually, numbers of doctors and nurses are going up. In schools is where we see some potential recruitment pressures building up. So the number of teachers being recruited into teacher training, particularly in things like STEM subjects, is falling far short of
What's
the government's target.
Subject?
So that's science, technology, engineering and maths, the things right. that are supposed to grow our economy in the future.
Is what's happening now really any different to what people have always said? I mean, essentially, there's never been a government department that has ever said, yeah, actually, I think we've got rather too much money and you should give it to someone else.
So I think the context of controlling spending has certainly sharpened minds in government. And there's a lot of interest in how we can kind of drive efficiency and productivity in public services. So the UK, across the private and public sector, has quite low productivity. So it gets less for the amount of money that it puts in compared to other countries. And so there's certainly a kind of an enthusiasm to do that, and as well as a need to do that in this context of less money coming into the public coffers.
Emily Andrews, thank you very much for that. So we've heard where our taxes go, roughly speaking, how they're performing. Now let's look at where they come from. Yes, geese. I'll explain. The finance minister, Louis XIV, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, once said that the art of taxation consists in so plucking the goose as to obtain the largest amount of feathers with the smallest possible amount of hissing. Helen Miller knows where to find the feathers. She's an associate director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, another non-partisan think tank, and she's in charge of their work on tax. Helen Miller, in very broad terms, how do we pay for things?
Well, if you add all those feathers up, then in total the government raises about £700 billion each year. That's the equivalent of about 37 pence for every pound earned in the UK. And if you split that bill equally, it would be about £11,000 per person. Now, it raises that money from a host of different taxes, but two-thirds of it comes from our three most important taxes, which are income tax, national insurance contributions, and both of those are a tax on income, and VAT, that's a tax on most stuff that you buy in the shops. We get about 12% from other taxes on things like tobacco, alcohol, and fuel. We get about 8% from corporation tax, another decent chunk from council tax, and all the rest comes from a whole host of smaller taxes, including things like capital gains and inheritance tax.
And also, presumably, we borrow.
We do borrow. So I told you the government raises about 37 pence in every pound. They spend about 40p in every pound, and the difference between that is borrowing, so it's the deficit.
OK, now, what's been going on with the tax take? I mean, we've talked about the era of austerity and so on, so one might presume that the amount of tax available to the government has gone down.
Overall, taxes are going up. So in the next few years, actually, tax as a share of national income will be at its highest level since the 1980s.
So the tax take has gone up.
It's gone up.
So how then have we got the situation that Emily described, which is that public services are feeling increasingly straitened? Tax up, public services down. Seems odd.
Well, I think basically what happened is we had a big financial crisis that put lots of spending pressure on. Spending went up relative to the size of the economy. So we've had to try to do two things. One is bring spending down and one is put taxes up. So far, most of austerity has come through bringing spending down. But as I said, taxes are slowly creeping up. The underlying problem is that we also have an ageing population and it's getting more expensive. So even to maintain the current level of services, we would need to find more money.
So who actually pays tax?
Well, that's a great question. So we can crunch the numbers for most of the main taxes. So if you think about income tax, NICS, VAT, council tax...
National Insurance Contribution.
If you think of those main taxes and we line up households according to how much income they have, then the top half of households, so the highest income households, pay 78% of all taxes. So basically, richer households pay more. But we also know that some taxes are particularly top-heavy. So that's true of income tax. So if you take income tax, the top half of income tax payers contribute over 90% of total income taxes, and the top 1%, so that's those individuals earning over £164,000, they're paying 27% of all income tax revenues.
Despite being what proportion of the population again?
Well, they're 1% of income tax payers, so actually less than 1% of the whole population, because not everyone pays income tax. So that top very small group are paying a very large chunk of income tax.
Over the years, we've had a lot of different governments taking people out of income tax. What effect has that had on who pays and who doesn't?
You see, you're right. That's been a big trend. And actually, it's been happening recently with the increase in the personal allowance means that more people don't have incomes high enough to pay income tax. So now, actually, 4 in 10 adults don't pay any income tax.
I mean, this is rather extraordinary. Who are the 40% of people who aren't paying tax?
They're a pretty eclectic bunch. So they include some people who are, for example, just not working because they're students. So they will be paying in future, but they're not paying right now. It includes some unemployed people. It includes some people who choose not to work. Maybe they're spouses of people who are working. And it importantly includes lots of people who are earning money, but they're earning below the personal allowance, either through work or through their pensions. So basically, they're not earning enough to be brought into the income tax system. Obviously, a lot of those people will be paying other taxes, for example, national insurance contributions or VAT or other taxes.
Yeah, so we shouldn't presume that just because people aren't paying income taxes, they're not actually paying taxes, in fact.
Absolutely. Everyone's paying tax in some way.
So what's happening at the bottom? I mean, what's the national average salary?
That's around, the median is, that's the person at the 50th percentile is around £27,000.
So we can say that the average person earns £27,000, although such person hardly exists.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So if the top 10% are paying so much, what's happening further down?
Well, so I think broadly what we've had is a trend, there's an underlying trend towards income equality. So people at the top are earning more of the income and people at the bottom are being taken more out of the tax system altogether. So the tax system is becoming more top heavy. The people who are paying the tax is coming more from the higher income households.
Now to the hissing. We asked people around the country how they'd feel about paying more tax.
Really? More? No. If we was to pay any more, I'd never have any money.
I wouldn't be against paying more tax. It just depends what it's getting spent on. If it's for services, if it's for benefit, the NHS are more than happy.
I'm happy to do my bit. If I had to pay a bit more so someone who needs it can have a bit more, then I'm happy.
Over the moon, no. No chance. I'd be really annoyed you have to pay more taxes.
I don't mind paying more tax if the government are going to use it properly.
I don't agree with paying tax. I'm in my mid-70s and I'm still paying tax. I don't want to pay any more tax. No, I don't think anybody does.
Yeah, I would, to help the NHS and whatever, yeah. I wouldn't mind doing that.
Paying more for tax sounds horrendous. I suppose it makes me a bit angry thinking about that.
I think that income tax should be raised by whatever is needed in order to provide proper health care facilities through the National Health Service.
I'm not happy.
No, I won't be happy neither. Paying up as it is.
No, no, we're not happy about that one at all.
We're not very good, are we?
No, no. Sorry, can't help you any further than that.
For something a bit more scientific, Ben Page is here. He's the chief executive of the polling firm Ipsos Mori. Ben, what does your research tell you about the reaction to the prospect of higher taxes?
I think what you've just heard is pretty typical. I mean, people in Britain want, you know, effectively Swedish-style services for American levels of taxation. So we want all the good things and we don't really want to pay for them. People sometimes say in surveys that they're willing to pay more tax, particularly if it's hypothecated, it's directed particularly to a particular service.
And let's say what hypothecation is.
So hypothecation is exactly what happened in 2001 when national insurance payments were raised, specifically, at least we were told, to pay for extra funding for the National Health Service. And that was actually popular because people, as we know, loved the NHS dearly, and they also felt at the time that it needed more money. When it gets more complicated when it's general taxation, and I think the difficulty here is, as with many areas of life, what people say about paying more tax and what they actually do at the ballot box are not always the same. So, and politicians know this, so they proceed with huge caution. But what we've seen over the last decade is a decline in the proportion of people saying that we should extend services or invest in more services if it means increases in taxes. It's actually started to rise, and we've still got 6 out of 10 people last year telling us that actually I'm willing to countenance more taxation if it means spending on the services I care about. But of course, the devil is in the detail.
How far does a perception of the competence of government affect their willingness to pay tax? Is that a feature?
It's hugely important. And I think this is the point. The public isn't actually perhaps as ideological as some people might believe about whether you believe in high taxes and lots of public services or a low tax state that leaves people to their own devices. But it does come down to competence. So back in 1992, when Neil Kinnock wanted to become Prime Minister, as many people thought that he would put up taxes if he was elected as Tony Blair in 1997, roughly the same proportion. The difference, and why perhaps one of the reasons why Tony Blair got a landslide victory and Neil Kinnock didn't, is simply that Tony Blair was seen as competent in spending that money. He and Gordon Brown spent a lot of time trying to persuade people that they were going to be prudent when they finally came to power.
Now, we heard earlier from people who said they just didn't know where their taxes went. How representative is that feeling of ignorance?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, again, very similar to what we find in quantitative surveys. People think that most of the money goes on the National Health Service. They massively underestimate how much pensioners are getting and overestimate how much is going on the working age poor. They massively overestimate how much is spent on things like defence, housing, and even aid to the developing countries.
Why do they think less goes on pensions than actually does?
Well, it's a hidden thing.
I mean, given that so many of them are pensioners.
These are large amounts of money and, you know, this is complex stuff and you have to be pretty geeky to really want to get into it. So, you know, if you look around at where you can see money being spent, you'll immediately think about the services you use. And, of course, the NHS is something that does touch the lives of virtually everybody in this country.
OK. Have you polled about who people think should pay more?
Well, it's generally people who are richer than, you know, you or richer than me, the proverbial me. So we quite like the idea of wealthy people paying more, whether they're on over £150,000 or £100,000 a year. But of course, the difficulty with this, as the Institute for Fiscal Studies has pointed out, is that taxing that wealthy group of people who are already contributing quite a large amount of tax doesn't necessarily raise enough. And generally, if you want to generalise, people think wealthy people are people earning about 10,000 £20,000 a year more than them. And everybody underestimates, exactly who might have to pay if we really wanted to make a step change in, say, funding public services.
You talked a bit earlier about some of the changes in attitudes to paying tax over time. Is there a generational factor here?
One of the things that's been most interesting in our work in the last 20 years or so is seeing, for example, a shift in attitudes to the welfare state. So people who were born before 1945, we now discover, when they were ever since they've been first polled by some of these long-running series, have said that the welfare state is one of the things that makes me proudest about being British. My generation, and I think yours too, David, born between 1945 and 1965, we're less likely. If you're born between 1966 to 79, you're less likely still to say that. And if you're born after 1980, you're less likely still. And the key point here is that these attitudes, it's not that young people don't like the welfare state, but they don't have the same emotional attachment to it that perhaps older generations do. And as older people die out, the dial is shifting.
Well, thanks to the three of you separately, let's kind of try and bring these things together and push them forward. Now, presuming that people don't want cuts or crisis in public services, it seems to be that we're left with a gap. And the question being how we're going to fill it. Helen Miller, can we just deal with this by borrowing more money?
The government could borrow some more. It's certainly not the case that we have to always raise taxes. But we can't borrow more forever and always. We can't keep adding to the stock of government debt. That would cause problems down the line. So that will get us a little way. And you might want to borrow to do things like invest in infrastructure or roads or things that have payoff in the future. But in terms of borrowing to do current spending, so to spend on nurses or teachers, if we want to spend more money, then eventually we're going to have to raise more money.
OK. Now, there's lots of ways, presumably, to get a few billion here or there.
Sure, there are definitely lots of ways. I think it's always worth remembering, of course, it's a political choice about how much to raise and who to raise it from. And that really means it's a choice of all of us as citizens about who we want to tax and who should be paying. All taxes come with trade-offs. There's no pain-free way. A very simple way to raise chunks of income would be to just increase the main rates of our workforce taxes. So income tax, NICs or VAT, if you put a penny on the main rates of those, you could raise decent chunks. Now, they would all take money more from higher income people. The trade-off there would be that you'd get more money, but you'd reduce incentive to go to work. But you could get some easy money there.
And there are other countries, successful countries, who do have higher rates of main rate income tax.
There are. Of course, it's always important to think about the whole tax system and all the different rates and how they interact together. But yes, we could have a penny on income tax and the system wouldn't collapse.
What about taxes on houses?
Well, that's a great one to talk about, I think.
Reason I raise this is because so much of our wealth seems to be bound up with housing.
It is. And of course, at the moment, the sort of one of the big taxes we have on housing is council tax. That's the tax you pay to live in your house. And we actually have a very bizarre system where the last time properties were valued was 1991. Just think about how much has changed since 1991. You can see it's absurd that we base our taxes.
That's the last time we did it. Yeah. We are now currently taxing on the basis of what things were worth 26 years ago.
We are. That's ridiculous, right? So not only that, so not only are we having these completely out-of-date property values, we also, council tax is levied in such a way that it's higher as a proportion of house value for lower value houses than for higher value houses. So the tax man is favouring people who live in higher value houses. So we could fix this whole mess by basically revaluing all houses, drag that system into the 21st century, and then change how the tax rates are set.
Ben, you smiled at that.
Well, housing, of course, is the Englishman's home is his castle, or the English person's home is his castle. I think this is where it gets very, very difficult. We've looked in the past for governments at how, for example, they fund social care and the fact that people need more help being looked after. We have now a social care crisis. And, of course, people, when we did this, we found people were... The idea of paying a bit more national insurance, as you do in Japan, when you hit the age of 40, so you might make it... You've got a chance now of making it to retirement. You've got to 40, that was sort of okay. But once you got onto taking people's housing wealth away from them, that's when the pitchforks and flaming torches came out. And that is really, really difficult, I think.
This is mucho hissing.
Yes, I think the hypothecation is really that telling people a specific tax for something they really care about, in this case the NHS and perhaps looking after older people, might be the most politically palatable thing to do. But as you can see, governments are, you know, got all sorts of challenges, and they really don't want to have to do it. Council tax revaluation, I think, is so toxic. It's a bit like those things that we put in drums and send off to foreign countries to be dealt with or just thrown away, because we just cannot bear to look at it, because politicians are still scarred by Mrs. Thatcher's experience in the 1990s.
Emily Andrews, you run the performance tracker. What about the performance of public services? Could part of the answer lie in reforming them to make them perform better for less?
So there are certainly different proposals out there of ways that we can get more out of our public services. So one of the big ones is service integration. So the idea is that if you bring your health care and your social care together, you can find ways of doing things more cheaply, because kind of social care provision is often cheaper than provision in hospitals. So having those two sectors working together will help keep people out of hospital. Another one is digital, which is a word that gets bandied around a lot and means lots of different things, but it's basically better use of technology which is enabled by the internet. That can have all different kinds of effects, from, again, to use the healthcare example, digitising patient records, which basically allows you to make administrative savings, so it's much cheaper than having pieces of paper passed backwards and forwards.
And we haven't yet done that, have we?
And that has not yet been done. No, it is extraordinarily difficult, and the NHS has really struggled with doing IT transformation. So there's kind of that administrative side, but it goes all the way from, you know, proposals to use different artificial intelligence to do diagnosis of patients so that you don't need to talk to your GP. So it kind of runs the full gamut of different ways we can use technologies to do things more cheaply.
Helen Miller, can I ask you about a couple of things which are areas for raising revenue which have been floated and become, I wouldn't say kind of fashionable, but you hear them around in the ether. Now, one, of course, is we've got a long way to go in clamping down on tax avoidance, so we'll get a lot of money that way. So if we can deal with that one first.
Sure. So I think the short answer to that is that, certainly where companies are concerned, there is no pot of gold at the end of the anti-avoidance rainbow, if you like. Governments are clamping down on avoidance in various ways, and there are more things they can do there. But if you think about corporations, we have a really difficult time trying to distinguish between cases where companies are sort of being naughty and artificially manipulating profits, and cases where they're just doing stuff offshore. Fundamentally, our system was designed in the 1920s, where companies were creating stuff you could drop on your foot. Now they're creating ideas and technologies, and it's really hard to work out where that should be taxed.
OK, let me take a second thing. It's one that has been talked about fairly recently, and that's the idea. What we should actually do is tax wealth. There's all this wealth that wealthy people have that isn't effectively taxed. What about that?
Yeah, so I think when you look at the unequal distribution of resources, it's obvious to see why people think that a wealth tax is appealing. Of course, you have to start about thinking, what do we mean by wealth? Do we mean artwork and jewellery, or do we also mean pension pots and housing? It's problematic and unfair if we only tax certain kinds of wealth. It's also really hard to tax wealth, because it's very hard for the government to work out who has wealth and how much it's worth each year. I think what I would say is, from an economics point of view, and this is much more important, we should remember that wealth arises when people get income or they get capital gains from the rise in the value of their assets. And for various reasons, it's more efficient and fair to tax the flows of those incomes rather than the stock of wealth. So one thing we could do, though, is look to the capital gains. We could tax capital gains more highly.
OK, now, one final point from you. What's the evidence about taxes and elections? We're coming into an election and everybody, by and large, says great things are going to happen and so on. And what they tend not to do is say you'll be paying more taxes afterwards. But what actually happens afterwards?
That's a great question. So actually, there's this common wisdom that before elections, governments cut taxes to woo voters. So actually, some colleagues of mine at the IFA did lots of number crunching and looked at what happens to taxes before and after election. And much to our surprise, what we found is that for each of the last six general elections, that's all elections since 1992, taxes have gone up substantially in 12 months after the elections. So even if parties don't tell you they're going to put up taxes, recent evidence suggests that taxes are going to go up anyway.
Ben Page, you're nodding.
Well, and that's what the public, of course, think. Whatever you say about taxes, the public think that you're going to put them up anyway.
That's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, Emily Andrews, Helen Miller and Ben Page. My producer for this edition was Neil Rozelle. Research was by Sarah Shabir. And if you have thoughts about The Briefing Room, there's an easy way to share them. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. For those of you who've already done so, thanks. We read them all. And before you go, please check this out.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Bowen, and I'd like to invite you to download my new series about the Middle East. I've been reporting from the region for more than a quarter of a century, and BBC Radio 4 has asked me to reflect on the major events I've covered in that time, and to recount some personal stories and experiences. You can listen on the Radio 4 website and in the iPlayer Radio app. Or there's a free podcast you can subscribe to if you prefer. The series is called Our Man in the Middle East. There are more details on the Radio 4 website.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.